Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to New Books Network. I'm Gyatim Silongkumar, the host of this channel. And today I'm here with Dr. Christo Dos to talk about his book, India After 1857 Revolt, Decolonizing the Mind. This book is an interesting book because it talks about India after 1857, and it talks about Christian nationalism and the influence of Christian missionaries and all of those aspects in the decolonial and also at the same time the nationalistic movement. So it'll be a really interesting conversation. I believe that we'll all have a fruitful time listening to this very conversation. So let me straight away go to the author himself. And Dr. Christo Dos, can you tell us something about yourself?
Thank you so much, Longkumar, for inviting me to part of your discussion series. I am so thankful and grateful. Well, I am a first-generation learner, first of all. I'm so happy to say this because sometimes you don't realize what exactly your potential is all about until others point it out, right? And as a first-generation learner, I did not realize that I would be able to write a book of this kind until budding historians whom I had series of interactions during my lecture time. So one of the very important things that I would like to share is how the ideas, dissent, debates that you have with your students in a way shape the idea that you are thinking about or would you like to expand. So this 1857 revolt, decolonizing the mind, I recollect what E.H. Carr, a very noted historian in his book, What is History, would say, history is obviously a continuous process of interaction between past and present. And in it, it is an unending dialogue between historians and their facts. So as a student of history, I always try to, read, reread what is exactly this interaction is all about, unending dialogue is all about. And finally, as a student of history, I also was keen on reading R.G. Collingwood, R.G. Collingwood's book, The Idea of History, where he would say, every new generation must rewrite history in its own way. He also would say every new generation should not be satisfied by giving new answers to old questions. So most importantly, he would say that historians therefore need to revise the questions themselves. So as a student of history, I always keep on reading, rereading, revisiting time and again these two scholars of repute, international repute. So what I'm trying to emphasize here is this book, India After the 1857 Revolt, Decolonizing the Mind, I would strongly say with conviction, it is in a way the result of my reading or my limited knowledge, which disseminated by R.G. Collingwood and E.H. Carr.
Can you tell us something about your academic background and also where you are teaching now?
Well, I taught a few colleges that are affiliated with the Delhi University. The first one, the first teaching assignment I got was Miranda House, Delhi University. Then after some time, I switched to a college, Jesus Mary College. Jesus and Mary College, again, that was affiliated to Delhi University. Now, for the past 6-7 months, I have been teaching history at Christ University in Bangalore.
So let's go into the contents of the book. And to first of all discuss the contents of the book, I think we need to clarify what this 1857 revolt is all about, or what is this revolt? So let me put that question to you. What is this 1857 revolt in India?
Well, in this book, I have not discussed about the causes or consequences or the implications of 1857 in a conventional writing. But I have tried to understand this 1857 how this 1857 revolt, in a way, can be understood as a watershed movement or a turning point in the history. Because for the first time, you find 1857 revolt created a kind of unity, maybe religious unity or cultural unity between Hindus or Muslims or Sikhs and other sections of the people. And of course, this 1857 of being interpreted by various scholars, different schools of thought, you have the British scholars try to understand this revolt for the first time as a Sepoy mutiny, right? Sepoys mutiny. But they were reluctant in identifying this as a revolution or revolt for political reasons. For example, you find the Marxist school of thought, you see scholars arguing that it is merely a feudal uprising against the British. Thirdly, you will find the historians whom some of the students of history would identify as a nationalist school of thought, like V.D. Savarkar, for example. And he uses the phrase national war of independence, war of independence. Now, the question is, I'm not going into the details of these schools of thought, how this 1857 revolt clearly shaped the discourse. On the one side, the cultural unity or the cultural continuity, and how this in a way united the social group for the first time culturally. And even I would prefer using some of the phrases used by V.D. Savarkar in his book written in 1909, India's War of Independence. He would say, Hindus and Muslims fought against the British, drinking the milk from the same mother, and they fought against the British. And that is the spirit of cultural unity or religious unity or sensibility these people of different social group were able to demonstrate against the colonial British. And this is very interesting, because when I was teaching this 1857, I would often get questions from students whom often I identify as budding historians. You know, they say that, why do we see only 1857 from a Marxist perspective? So why do we see only from a national perspective? Why can't we revisit the history writing of the existing, historiography? And they would often ask me that, do we really need to think that the 1857 revolt was an isolated movement, or it has a deeper meaning? The second question they would ask me often is, why don't we transcend the boundaries of the existing schools of thought? Can't we see colonialism or colonization as a cultural project of the British? So these questions really shaped my understanding. Yes, here we as historians need to take a pause and see what exactly happened and how the history of anti-colonial movement therefore gets its energy and inspiration from this cultural unity and the religious harmony that 1857 brought among different social groups, which is why I try to see this 1857 therefore needs to be understood critically and historically.
Yeah, this is an interesting revisitation in that sense. So, and yeah, and interestingly, you talk a lot about the Christian missionaries and then the colonial administrator. So to go into that discussion, first of all, I want to ask you this one, where what was the view towards the Hindus or the Hindu religion, let's say, towards the Hindu religion by the colonial administrators and also together with the Christian missionaries, because they came together. So what was their view towards the so-called Hindu religion? Yeah.
Well, I think this is a very interesting question. If you look at the colonial approach towards Hinduism or the colonial missionaries' approach towards Hinduism, I don't see any major difference between the colonial government and the missionaries, for example. Now, There are very interesting theories that are emerging in the post-colonial period. Of course, I am not making any sweeping generalization that all colonial officials were against Hinduism, first of all. Even people now who are talking about Hindu nationalism or Hindutva also try to, appropriate some of the colonial officials to substantiate that argument that Hinduism was subtle, Hinduism was inclusive, Hinduism always tried to, be inclusive of all religious traditions. But now the question is, the situation changes drastically after 1857. The approach of the colonial officials or the approach of the missionaries towards Hinduism. Let me give you a few examples. For the first time, after 1850s, I'm just giving you an example from the perspective, from the historical instances where you find in southern part of India, the missionaries started writing some of the social histories of the people. So, for example, the people who showed interest towards Christianity became the subject of inquisitiveness. This is the point which I would like to emphasize. So the missionary agencies for the first time tried to show interest because these communities were in a way trying to come closer to the missionary ideologies, converting themselves to Christianity. And sometimes they became serious followers of the missionary sermon, and they were not very reactionary. And I'm using one particular community here as a case study. There's a community called Shanars or Nadars. And you find here this community, unlike other communities, in southern part of Tamil Nadu were always pro-missionary. And they were always, expressed their interest towards converting to missionary religion. But this particular movement towards Christianity by this community was taken for granted by some missionary scholars. And the missionary scholars, particularly Robert Caldwell. Robert Caldwell was a very noted missionary. He became the bishop. And secondly, he was also one of the very important Tamil scholars. Now his statue also can be found in Marina Beach in Chennai. Right, that is the personality of Robert Caldwell, and he is known widely for his comparative literature on Dravidian languages, and he wrote exclusively on the Shanar community. And he uses certain phrases like dull-headed Shanars. So this dull-headed Shanars now as a phrase did not go very well with the people who did not convert to Christianity. The converted Christians had no problem with Caldwell, whatever he made remarks against Hinduism and the non-Christians. But whereas those people who did not convert to Christianity had serious problems, and these people also from the same community. Now, it is in this context, we cannot make any sweeping generalization that one missionary was completely against Hinduism and few missionaries at least supported some ideas, values of Hinduism in Tamil Nadu. And in the case of Bengal, for example, you don't find missionaries were always against critical about Hindus and Hindus. Some of the Hindus from the elite section converted to Christianity. And therefore, they sometimes try to avoid criticizing Hindu religion or Hinduism, for example, Hindus, because they were also able to get some of the converts from the elite section. And secondly, if you look at Travancore, for example, from 1806, the Protestant missionaries, the London missionary societies, they were critical about Hinduism, because they always felt Hinduism is nothing but casteism, and casteism is nothing but Brahminism, and Brahminism therefore was detrimental to their religion, and therefore they were always critical about Hinduism. And Hinduism was therefore criticized for religious reasons, not for creating any, you know, egalitarian society, or they want to break the caste, or annihilation of caste. They always tried to see Hinduism and casteism went hand in hand. And sometimes the missionaries would say that the blood of castes was thicker than the blood of their religion. So how do we see it? So again, they are trying to trace the history of religion, particularly Hinduism. And they always say this Hinduism, Brahmanism, and casteism. So these three isms were always used by the missionaries interchangeably, right? If you look at casteism, they will say, oh, this is Brahmanism. And Brahmanism is there because of Hinduism. So therefore, they're always trying to attack Hinduism, because Hinduism for them was always seen as something, a huge stumbling block for propagation of their religion. So therefore, you have different stories from different geographical terrains. So I don't have any single answer that whether missionaries could be charged for their anti-Hindu sentiments, or the colonialism had to be charged for their stand against Hindu religious practices. I think both of them are equally responsible in their own rights.
Yeah, that is very true. Now, you also talk about education. And I think education in terms of, you know, the search of anti-colonial sentiments. And I think this is a very interesting aspect, because I think this is where we talk about colonial education and the education that was propagated by the missionaries. So how much of these two has played their role, and, you know, how much of these two has kind of given that kind of sentiment, and which one has greater role to play? So you kind of talk about this one. So can you elaborate more on this education aspect of it? Yeah.
Yes, I think the education is a very interesting and intriguing for me for a number of reasons. Because when you think of education, I don't think only missionaries or colonial government played any major role. Of course, they played a crucial role. But we also need to take into account the role played by the indigenous schools of education. So I'm not ignoring that part, right? I'm not saying that education started only after, you know, 1813 Charter Act, or for that matter, 1853 Macaulay's Minute. Of course, even before the colonial government's initiatives, we also need to see the indigenous school of thought. But when we look at the history of education after 1857, or at least 1850s, I need to share a few important aspects. The first major, you know, complexity that arises in the 1850s, for example, after Macaulay's Minute, I think all of us know how his motive was to create a class of people, of persons, Indian in blood, you know, and the color, but English in tastes, in opinions, then in morals and intellect. This is one aspect. I'm just trying to explore this particular aspect, what exactly he means, right? And if you analyze historically and critically, one would definitely notice that colonialism and education cannot be considered as a separate watertight compartment. So in my research also, I try to analyze that how education was used, of course, with the purpose of expansion, or maybe with a view to civilize the Indian masses, and how this particular aspect of civilizing mission that was closely attached with the colonial endeavors of education, be it the supposedly secular education, or the religious education, or Anglo vernacular education by these colonial agencies. I'm using colonial agencies to refer to both the colonial government and the missionaries. Maybe mostly I'm using missionaries in the context of Protestant missionaries. So that is the missionary that I am, you know, familiar with, because this is also part of my research. Now, how these endeavors initiated by the colonial government and missionaries in a way created intellectuals like Ram Mohan Roy, for example, you know, he would say that, yes, English should also be retained, but you also need to give much importance to vernacular education. And here, secondly, you also find Swami Vivekananda also start talking about there's a different approach towards education. He's also not completely against English education. He also would try to balance, yes, English education is also needed. Vernacular education is also equally important. Now, the paradigm shift in the 1850s, of course, Ram Mohan Roy comes a little earlier, you know, 1820s or 1830s. Now, after Macaulay's Minute, you find that is there is a transition taking place. You know, you find in Bengal, Swami Vivekananda and other parts of India, you'll find leaders like Agarkar in Bombay Presidency, D.K. Carvey, then Tilak, for example, and Gopal Krishna Gokhale. And in, again, Bombay Presidency, you find Jyotiba Phule. And in places like Uttar Pradesh, you have Pandit Madan Mohan Malviya. And finally, you have Mahatma Gandhi. And I also see the role played by foreigners, particularly a woman called Annie Besant, how she was always critical about colonial education. She was, I think, deadly against colonial and missionary education because she possibly was the first person who emphasized the need for national education. That doesn't mean that I'm not taking the role played by colonial education and missionary education lightly. But here, since 1853, Macaulay's Minute emphasizes on the moral side of the education, the character building of education, and the colonial conquest of education. And here also, therefore, these individuals wanted to decolonize education. And therefore, that's the reason why I'm using decolonization. So decolonization by whom? Why? There is a need for decolonization. So if there is a need for decolonization, these individuals must have realized that there is or there were some draws or there were some flaws in the system. So what were these flaws identified by these individuals? For example, let me say a few things about Annie Besant. She always believed strongly that, you know, alien education, she uses always the concept alien education, always emphasizes on foreign habits, foreign mannerism, foreign religion. And therefore, she advocates that if India was to come back again as a nation, it must replace foreign education with a national education. And in the recent new education policy, national education policy, I think you also find the reference, at least to some extent, directly or indirectly, the role played by Annie Besant, Mahatma Gandhi, and Swami Vivekananda. Yes, you have at least multiple narratives that started emerging after 1857. So these multiple narratives, in a way, challenge the colonial narrative of education. So the colonial narrative of education for me was controversial because it was always trying to create a group of people who may be Indian in blood and color, but it was keen on establishing the people English in taste, in opinions, in morals, and in intellect. And therefore, as a student of history, I feel that there is a need to rewrite this aspect of the narratives, how multiple narratives started emerging. And therefore, I'm thinking this should also be researched further. What exactly national education? What was the role played by missionaries or the colonial official that in a way triggered Indian masses or Indian intelligentsia to think about counter-narrative?
Yes, I think that's a really great exposition on education in India and the, you know, influence of colonial administrators and the missionaries at the same time, and also the need to really look into it, you know, re-look into the aspect of education in India, and, you know, as you brought out the new education policy also. So that's really quite interesting. That's something which we need to think about. Now, as we move forward, you talk about the missionary satyagrahis, obviously influenced by Gandhi, and also their setback, the criticism also towards the missionary endeavor in terms of the conversion and all of those aspects. So this is a very interesting aspect as to, okay, the missionaries came, but then also they themselves kind of supported this, you know, decolonization movement, and then they became critical of the conversion movement. So this is a very interesting perspective that you gave. So can you please elaborate on this one? Yeah.
Thank you, Lankumar. I think this has a very interesting story. When I was going through the old documents at National Archives of India in Delhi, I was really going through a period where I was not able to express the joy, literally. Because for the first time, a student of history like me, who was always taught that all missionaries were bad and all missionaries were against Indian nationalism, and therefore all missionaries need to be condemned. And this is the story. You know, this was the lesson. This was the teaching. And this also the history book tells us. And at a time when I go through these documents and you see that people who were influenced or persuaded by Gandhian ideology, they're one by one, they are leaving their faith, they are saying goodbye to their proselytization project, and one by one, they are slowly joining and strengthening the hands of Gandhiji. I think this is really, really interesting. Because I have a long list of such missionary Gandhians or Gandhian missionaries to say. Two individuals, for example, you can think of. For example, Verrier Elvin is one example. Verrier Elvin, who came as a missionary and he was influenced by Gandhian ideologies. And second is a person, Charles Andrews. C.F. Andrews, you know, if you look at the collected works of Mahatma Gandhi series, you will find hundreds of letters written or exchanged between Mahatma Gandhi and Verrier Elvin, Mahatma Gandhi and Charles Andrews, and from Charles Andrews to Gandhi and earlier Verrier Elvin to Gandhi. So here, I think it's very interesting during this time, you know, in 1920s and 1930s, I find that there are two schools of nationalism started emerging. And these schools of thought were constructed by the missionaries themselves, not any Indian intelligentsia. Not even Gandhi was thinking about these two nationalisms. Gandhi's nationalism was always against the British, and he always used to say soul force against military force. But here, these missionaries who were influenced by Gandhian ideology now started constructing their ideas of nationalism for the first time in India. So I find that there are two ideas which have started emerging. One is, aggressive nationalism, and second one is redemptive nationalism. I am also using the term redemptive nationalism. So, identifying themselves with, redemptive nationalism, these missionaries started arguing persuasively that it was the aggressive nationalism that was responsible for all kinds of turmoils all over the world. It is not only about India, the aggressive nationalism. And on the contrary, they would say, unlike aggressive nationalism, they would say redemptive nationalism is needed for India. Aggressive nationalism always associated with the colonialism, colonial power, imperialism, colonizing the mind. But on the contrary, redemptive nationalism was all about redeeming the colonizer as well as the colonized. How one can redeem the mindset. So these missionaries would often say that redemptive nationalism is something to do with the mindset. It's not only the mindset of the colonizers, but also about the mindset of the colonized. Missionaries, they would argue that it's passion and the primary objective of what they called redemptive nationalism in a way was to liberate self. Liberating the self in order that everyone will be liberated from the very idea of ruling, very idea of oppression or oppressing others or suppressing others and dominating others and expressing a kind of, you know, powerful mentality, the civilizing mindset. And therefore, these Gandhian missionaries would continue to assert that all struggles against the British could be done only through redemptive nationalism. Redemptive nationalism, according to them, it's a non-violent nationalism. And this redemptive nationalism also was something which can be traced back to the biblical idea. Right? They are not explicitly expressing that they have taken it from a Bible or biblical principles. But what one identifies is the ways in which Christ was advocating justice for everyone, equality for everyone, liberty for everyone, and brotherhood for everyone, we also need to apply. We also need to redeem the people from the very mindset of ruling the others. And therefore, they appeal to the people that they should follow this redemptive nationalism to identify India's struggle for independence. I think there are a number of historical studies we can read, but I don't find any term of this kind, redemptive nationalism, in the Indian context. Of course, there are few works have been used in the Western African context. So I am so happy that I'm able to use this term to refer to Gandhi's implications and how missionaries who came to India with an intention of proselytizing others were able to be converted by Gandhi's ideas for India's nationalism. Yeah, this is very, very interesting aspect of it. I'm still interested to explore a little more deeper how this notion can be understood in various contexts.
That aspect of Gandhi and his influence is something which is really interesting. And yeah, thank you for pointing that out. Now, again, you talk about the indigenous Christian nationalists, and also they had their own baggage with the Indian government. And also at the same time, there was this movement of Christian ashram. All of those aspects were there. So can you elaborate more on their relation to the Indian political scenario and the Christian nationalist movement here in India? Yeah.
Yes, yes. I think it's a very interesting question because, again, there is a notion that is deeply entrenched in the minds of the people. The notion is the entire Christian community or Christians were with the colonialism or with the British missionaries or with the missionaries. This is, I think, need to be rewritten. What I understand is the story is the other way around. Even sometimes Gandhiji would say that the contribution of Christians to Indian nationalism was almost negative in character. I strongly disagree with this point of view. Because, again, I need to clarify this, that the term Christians, I don't think it is monolithic category. This is an area where it is thoroughly researched by scholars like Geoffrey Audi, right? So I'm not using the term Christians anyway as a monolithic category, because while converts from elite Hindu social order preferred, you know, a completely Hindu customs, they wanted always to retain Hindu customs. On the other side, converts from these marginalized sections were always keen on rushing towards the Western habits. And the third, as Geoffrey Audi would say, that there were kind of Christians who were almost sandwiched between these two. So this third category of converts appear to be partly Indian and partly Western in their behaviors and habits. So this is what I think one has to look at, the complex nature of Christians as a community. So Christians in India can no longer be seen as a monolithic category, number one. Secondly, when I use the word sandwiched Christians, I mean how Christians in India were sandwiched between westernization and anti-colonial struggles. I would like to rephrase here what I stated, because Christian community or communities had dual struggle. on the one side, they were challenging the westernization of Christianity. On the other side, some of the Christian leaders were always joining hands with the Indian National Congress against colonial hegemony. Now, these initiatives by Christians, you know, reached its zenith as soon as Indian National Congress was established in 1885. Now, you find number of leaders across India. That is clearly expressed in the case of Bengal, for example, in 1870s and 1880s. I was able to read a number of original writings from a magazine called Harvest Field from 1880s and 1890s. Here, Indians, you know, it is Indians as well as missionaries continue to emphasize the idea that India needed a Hinduized Christianity. India needed a Hinduized Christianity. Second, they would say no man on becoming a Christian need to depart from his or her national habits and dress. So how I'm looking at these statements is there are parallel movements, anti-colonial movements. On the one side, the movement was against the British politics. On the other side, the Christians who are sandwiched between these two ideas were keen on exploring their ideas, anti-colonial sentiments, by identifying themselves more with the Hinduism or Hindu-ness or Indian-ness. Now, there are many case studies in Bengal, for example, K.M. Banerjee, Kali Charan Banerjee, for example. These are elite, you know, Brahmins, who always converted to Christianity, and they were questioning the Europeanization of Christianity. And one example I can say, Kali Charan Banerjee, he introduced a kind of Indo-centric Christianity or religious practices, where he would, you know, advocate some of his Christian converts, saying that we should not discontinue our Hindu practices like dancing, singing procession, popular customs that are closely linked with our cultural self. Why there is need to de-link our Hindu cultures? You may be a Christian, but that doesn't mean that you have to disconnect yourself or with your culture or with your practice. And this, I think, is very, very interesting, because this particular history clearly tells us how Christians or Christianity were not completely with the British or the Europeanized Christianity. So there were, of course, attempts made by Indians, Indian leaders, converts, and who were always able to at least challenge the Europeanization of Christianity, and were always defending their customs. And at least you also find, even after their conversion, they would continue to use the caste titles. Like even after conversion to Christianity, for example, people, particularly the Shanar community that I was talking about, even after conversion, now they are identifying themselves as Nadars. Even after conversion, they would prefer to retain their caste title. So that also says a lot about, even after conversion, they still are keen in retaining some of the customs, conventions, practices, beliefs, and so on and so forth. And secondly, in the case of Madras presidency, for example, you find there's a very popular person called Bengal Chakrai. He was a congressman. He was a politician. But he believed that there should be a decolonization when it comes to Christianity. Say, he would say that Christianity should be nationalized. It's a very interesting story. How Christianity should be nationalized? Because he also felt that Christian missionaries always tried to use the Western theological rhetorics. Western theological rhetorics were not able to be followed by common folk, common people. Therefore, it should be indigenized or Hinduized or nationalized. And similarly, you will also find in the case of Andhra, I made a very interesting study where you find there's a person called Bishop Azaria. He was the first Indian bishop. And he was sent to Edinburgh in 1910. I also visited as part of my research, you know, when I was doing my PhD at JNU. And I was able to see some of his photographs. And this Azaria was sponsored by some of the missionaries from Madras. And Azaria was always known for his anti-missionary attitude, anti-colonial mindset. And in the conference where he delivered in 1910, he always wanted to ask the missionaries that we don't need your money, your materialism. We need your love. When we ask for love, you are not able to give us. You are always showing your superiority. You are always showing your racial differentiation. Even when we come to meet us, you don't provide us chair to sit in your room with you. So how do you think that you are advocating a religion which, you know, talks about equality, liberty, fraternity, brotherhood? And therefore, in this conference, 1910, he said, we do not plead for returning calls. We do not plead for handshakes. We do not plead for chairs, dinners, teas. We ask for your love. Give us your love, friends. This is the popular, you know, statement. And subsequently, he also wanted to challenge the dominance of the British missionaries, saying that we are no longer interested to work along or work under your leadership. And therefore, for the first time, Indian Missionary Society started emerge. Indian Missionary Society. So I'm using here Indian Missionary Society because people like Azaria was not able to work under the supervision and control of missionaries. And for the first time in the history of Christianity, there are ideas like Indian men, Indian money, and Indian material, for the first time in the history of Christianity, started emerging merely because of Azaria's initiative. And therefore, I think as someone who is interested and passionate about these historical transitions, one has to relook at how Christianity in India started emerging, how Christians in India underwent a series of challenges, difficulties, and therefore the notion that all Christians were supporters of the British, all Christians were the supporters of missionaries, need to be relooked at, need to be redefined, and need to be rewritten. And this is what I think I have done in this book.
Thank you very much for that. And as our conversation has come to an end, can you tell us about any projects that you are currently working on, or anything that you are academically you're currently working on? Yeah.
Yes. Thank you, Long Kimir. I am currently working on a book, which is almost at the verge of completion from my side. This, I see, it's a continuation of my earlier book. And this book is, which I have titled, is From Colonialism to Communalism. This colonialism to communalism, I find always, again, this is also an attempt to rewrite history, because how India had no history of communalism in the way it is constructed by the colonial British. Because for the first time, Indian history was written in a very controversial manner, communalization of history, racialization of history, periodization of Indian history by James Mill. It was James Mill in his book, History of British India, who tried to periodize Indian history on religious lines, Hindu India, Muslim India, and British India. So this periodization, in my argument in this book, I'm trying to make here how this communalization, racialization of Indian history, periodization of Indian history on religious lines need to be relooked. and how this periodization over a period of time led to concepts like Hindu communalism, Muslim communalism, right, and colonialism during colonial period, communalism during colonial times. So I don't think it should be understood as communalism. In my argument, I would try to see as communitarianism, because colonialism tried to construct this communalism because they always tried to see that unity within the people of India would be detrimental to the colonial politics. And therefore, they were always against unity of any social group. Unity of any social group was not welcome, did not see in a positive manner. And therefore, in my study, I would try to analyze that it is not communalism like the way it was construed by the colonial British, because it was a colonial agenda, dividing Indian history, identifying people on religious lines. And it is communitarianism, which always wanted to unite the people, and how this communalism was a British invention. It may not be applicable in the Indian context. This is what I'm trying to relook.
Yeah, really interesting project. So if anyone wants to reach out to you regarding your book, how do they reach out to you?
Normally through email. I normally interact. I would love to interact with my students, teachers, and scholars across globe. And yes, I'm looking eagerly for the Indian edition also, South Asian edition.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you very much for that. And I would like the listeners to get a hold of this book when the Indian edition comes, and then keep the conversation rolling on. And yeah, thank you very much, Dr. Christodos, for being here at New Books Network. It's been a pleasure having this conversation with you. Yeah, take care.
Thank you, Lokhtumir, for inviting me to your series of book discussion. It's absolutely my pleasure.